This KABU program has been made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from the Portland Alliance, the city's oldest alternative progressive newspaper, reporting on issues ignored or distorted by corporate-dominated media and providing a voice for social justice activists, environmentalists, trade unionists, and the progressive community. Information at 503-239-4991 or theportlandalliance.org.
I wish I was a mole in the ground. Yes, I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. You are tuned to KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland, where it's time now for the Old Mole Variety Hour. That's part one of the Monday morning radio zine. I'm Clayton Morgridge. Our engineer is Tammy Dean. The Mole comes to you every week at this time with news and commentary from an underground perspective. The Mole works out of sight, looking at politics and social movements the mass media prefer to ignore, but like a mole in the manicured gardens of the well-to-do, it pops up where least expected to reveal that there is life below the mass media radar screen. Karl Marx called this old mole the revolution. Here's some news we hope you can use. Organizations from Portland's peace and social justice community are planning a mass mobilization against war on the third anniversary of the invasion of Iraq. A march and rally entitled End the War, Begin the Peace will be held on Sunday, that's this coming Sunday, March 19th, in Portland's Waterfront Park south of the Morrison Bridge, gathering at 1:30 p.m. with the event beginning at 2. The sub-themes of the event are Bring All the Troops Home Now, no more blood for oil, End the Occupations of Iraq, Afghanistan, the West Bank, and Gaza, Fund Education, Healthcare, Jobs, and the Environment, Not War, Military Recruiters Out of Schools, and Respect Human Rights and International Law, Stop the Torture and Spying. So that's at the Waterfront Park south of the Morrison Bridge on Sunday at 1:30. And we're going to talk more about the march and have some people involved in organizing it on at the end of the show. Okay, on today's show, we'll be discussing why people drop out of politics and what would make politics a more integral part of their lives. The Well-Read Red has some thoughts about Bush's nuclear deal with India. And the Movie Moles will be talking about Crash, winner of the Oscar for Best Picture. Douglas Raybeck is a professor of anthropology at Hamilton College who's been thinking about why people are drawn into political life and why so many pay no attention to it. He's on the phone now with the old mole, Bill Resnick. Bill?
Thanks, Clayton. And Douglas Raybeck, welcome to KABU here in Portland, Oregon.
Good morning, Bill. Nice to join you.
Douglas Raybeck identifies himself as a psychological anthropologist. He's written a good deal. I think his latest book is On the Future, as a futurologist. He's been engaged here, at least engaged this month, in a debate in the New York Times. He had a letter on why serious newspapers and journals are losing audience while celebrity mags are going great guns. So, Douglas Raybeck, why are U.S. North Americans spurring serious thinking and citizenship and politics, but really getting themselves involved in trivial pursuits?
This is going to take a while, Bill. Let me give you three approaches. First, a good segment of the American population is attending to serious news, and by that I do not mean network news. They attend NPR, and their listenership has gone up, and their funding has gone up. But national news, CBS, NBC, ABC, and God knows Fox, isn't news.
Mm-hmm.
It's processed mucilage. As for the trivial, the principal issue is that the trivial is manageable. People can read simple stories, listen to simple television shows, understand and identify with characters, and have some sense of pattern and structure in their life. When you look at the world at large, particularly the way it's being pre-processed in 30-second sound bites, all you get is this grand melange of ungovernable, unstructured, unmanageable confusion. And people tend to retreat from that. Mm-hmm. It frightens them. Yeah, everyone likes to feel they have a sense of control in their life.
They also are now sort of retreating into religion, right? There's, simple theories of good and bad, and it gives them a structure and an anchor for their lives.
No, that's exactly right. Fundamentalism started on the rise about 20 years ago, and it's accelerated as this whole process has accelerated. It provides very nice, simple answers. You know, every word of the Bible shall be taken literally, and it is true and to be followed. Of course, most of the people who subscribe to this haven't read it and are unaware of the inconsistencies in it, but that's immaterial. They listen to people who basically mask the inconsistencies and provide them with a comforting sense of certainty and a real approach to simplicity.
Mm-hmm. There's a number of other, it seems to me, factors involved. Maybe you could comment on them. One of them is that, the celebrity mags or the gossip or sort of the religious stuff, it permits people to get together. When everybody is doing, when a lot of the people in your neighborhood are doing the same thing, and it's like kids, they all have to have the same games or watch the same TV shows, even if they're not terribly interested in them, but because that's the currency of conversation. You can talk to others, you can make contact with others based in this common knowledge, and that's become the common knowledge, as Angela Jolie or Pam Anderson or stuff. I mean, that's where you can really have conversations with people. How about that as a hypothesis?
As a hypothesis, I think there's something to it, but I wouldn't push it very hard. That sort of thing has been around since I was a kid, and to date myself, in high school we were talking about Rocky and Bullwinkle. Okay.
Well, I'm older than you are.
Really?
Uh-huh.
Oh, I'm impressed.
Possible.
Possible, yes.
Yeah, keep your head down a little while. True. I think that has been a lot. Well, of course, all of these phenomena have been around for a while, it seems to me, but it's still sort of important. It's not particularly.
Yeah, but what's going on now that didn't go on with Rocky and Bullwinkle? When we talked about it, it was, clever jokes and wasn't that funny, and you might even try to do a riff on it in mm-hmm. high school. But now what's happened is people are becoming absorbed in these personalities. They're getting the distinct impression that they know them. The publication of us, we,
right.
You, me, I, all of these things, people and so forth. I go to the college gym to work out, and students who bring these things when they're on the treadmills and so forth, principally women, these are the magazines. They're not news magazines. They're magazines devoted to celebrity movies and what you and I would find, I think, somewhat shallow.
Improving the self, there's a lot of that, too, when I go to the gym. Of course, in the gym they have these self and how to get slimmer and more pretty. And for men too. I want to challenge that slur about women reading this junk. The men have their own forms of junk, it seems to me.
Well, no, it's principally that the men tend to work out with free weights and Nautilus.
Oh, I see.
They can't read.
They can't read at all.
Yes. I have no expectation that they would be doing better.
Okay. How about another factor that seems to me involved that's structural is that this, politics has become not only more specialized, but that, our political issues are major kinds of questions of how we live together in social organization. But people become, it seems to me, less, in just daily life, things are managed in a way where their work and their lives are more routine and structured by others, to the extent where the kind of decision-making and thinking and just sort of and talking about important things and making judgments is sort of less and less. And once you get out of the habit of that, it seems to me it becomes, and if it's not become habitualized and you don't get the joy of that sort of higher order thinking, it becomes very hard to do. You know, if it's lose it or use it or lose it, it seems to me, really does apply to sort of that kind of higher order thinking.
No, I think that's fair. I think I'm afraid that's reflected in our education system from very early on, right through college. And I don't mean that anyone's trying to dumb students down. It's that we tend to hand them things in bite-sized pieces and ask for a quick turnaround. The student never gets a sense of control, never gets a sense of venturesomeness. I won't say never, but it's rare. And by the time they get to college, I'm a nasty old duffer, so I assign a 30-page research paper in a couple of my upper-level courses. And those research courses are not well-subscribed. A typical enrollment is 9 students.
Really? Even for a personable and charming guy like you?
Even for a personable, charming fellow like myself, I've even got a few teaching awards to my credit. But I'm a tough codger, and that reputation is out. It does self-select for some very good students, and I'm very pleased at that. But for the most part, even those students almost uniformly tell me that's the first time they've had to write a paper that long, and this is usually their junior or senior year. So to go back to the point, yes, I don't think people are well prepared for independent planning, independent research, taking an independent perspective, pushing it, supporting it, arguing for it. I just don't think there's too much practice there. Mm-hmm. And it is, in fairness, a much nastier world than you and I grew up in. There's a positive feedback loop, if you don't mind the technical term, running amok that we all have to deal with, even though we don't control it and can't control it. And that's the information explosion.
Mm-hmm.
I started using computers in about the mid-80s, and it led to a 30% increase in my productivity. Isn't that wonderful? The only problem is, of course, it led to an increase in everybody's productivity, which meant I had to attend to more material, which means I needed to buy a more powerful computer. To increase my productivity and to increase my ability to process information, which, of course, leads other people to do the same, but that's okay because now we've got email and the web. Well, yes, but that does more of the same, so now I have a trio, which includes my PDA as well as my phone and email and so forth.
Right.
So I need never take a break.
Right, but that, of course, leads to another thing, too, it seems to me. There is somewhat more sophistication, even if people run away from it. It seems to me one can, in fact, find lots of reasons to be hopeful in the modern world. On lots of issues, it seems to me people are actually smartening up. They're getting less smart and less involved in politics. Actually, Douglas Rabeck, I've got to do a station ID now and introduce you. This is KBOO Radio 90.7 FM, Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour, talking to Douglas Rabeck, who teaches at Hamilton College and has lots of ideas about why people are involved in politics and particularly involved in trivial pursuits and why that's happening. We've discussed a series of reasons, and now we're getting into the other side of the story, which is, what can be done? Are there possibilities in the modern world of reinvolving people in actually thinking about their lives, and are there any hopeful signs that can be built on? I've got a few theories about that. What do you think, Douglas?
Yes, but I don't know about making it a mainstream affair. It could happen. If it does, it'll prove to be very disjunctive. Part of the reason we're caught in this system is, in a sense, because our economy demands it. If everybody does what might be done, let me, if you don't mind, get a little technical. Most of the changes I've been talking about are what we call first-order changes. You can identify them, they increase, and it's a little bit like a flywheel, gradually increasing its rate and its complexity. Then there's a second-order change, and that is literally a break with the system. And that is increasingly happening, and I'm on your side in this. There are people who are establishing alternative living situations. I'm about to retire, and one of the things my wife and I looked at was co-resident situations. Those looked interesting and attractive. There are people who are executives in New York who are literally screaming, throwing up their hands, and heading for Vermont for a very alternative lifestyle.
Right.
But that is not the bulk of, you know.
Well, let me offer another hypothesis then. Let's talk not about sort of politics, but let's talk about areas of personal life like child rearing. Now, it's really changed radically over the last 50 years, and people have come to very different ideas. And to some extent, of course, the transition is very difficult, but there's really a lot less hitting of children and a lot more effort to reason, to do developmental things. I mean, you know, there's a lot of jokes about it, and people carry it too far, and some don't know how to do discipline. But in fact, just the sort of the recourse to the paddle and the whip and the harsh word, that's gone down, and people recognize that it's not a good way of dealing with kids, and they're sort of trying other means, mostly women, of course. But it seems to me that that reflects actually a considered, I mean, people really are concerned about their child rearing. Most of them, they read books. You know, that's one of the top-selling books is child rearing. There is thinking going on out there, and people actually are struggling towards sort of more democratic forms, even though in political life and in this froth of TV, you don't really see very much of that. How's that for a hypothesis?
I think that's a good hypothesis, and you can see it happen. All you have to do is look for it. There are students here. There's one young woman in particular who runs a major volunteer organization, more than 400 students involved in it. And she is single-handedly bootstrapping this place into some very nice participation of a social nature.
Mm-hmm.
And the more she accomplishes, the more she wants to accomplish. In part, these students reflect early childhood experiences where they were given the opportunity to assume responsibility, to make achievements, and they liked it, and they continued doing it. I think that is a hopeful sign. I don't know how widespread it is, but I would be hopeful that the basic message for people in your media who are committed to these ideas would be to get people to start small. You know, it's not necessarily trying to change the national game as much as it is working at your local level for two reasons. One, you can make a great deal of change there. Two, you really get a great deal of reinforcement, not only for yourself, but for others who can see what you're doing.
Right. Douglas Rabeck, I'm afraid we are... We're going to have to give way to the next segment of our thing. Let me give you one final hypothesis that you might want to explore in your writing, is we really do have to change the nature of work so that in that area where people really devote a great deal of their lives, probably the single greatest thing besides sleeping, is ultimately an employment of one kind or another, that they're really involved in participating and thinking, and that would really change things. Anyway, but I'm afraid we can't go beyond that right now. Let's talk again. Thanks a lot for talking to us.
It's been a pleasure, Bill.
Right.
You take care.
So long.
And this is the Old Mole Variety Hour. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour here on KBOO. I want to make a correction about the announcement that I made at the top of the show about the march on Sunday. That should be the north side of the Morrison Bridge, not the south side, the north side. Well, we just heard Bill Resnick talking with Douglas Raybeck. I'm Clayton Morgridge, and here's our regular feature, The Well-Read Red. Good morning, comrades. President Bush has just negotiated a deal with India, a nation that has tested nuclear weapons, that would provide it with nuclear fuel and technology for civilian purposes while allowing it to continue its nuclear weapons program. This is in plain violation of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, which restricts such aid to nations that have signed the treaty, which India has not. The New York Times comments that this deal threatens to blast a bomb-sized loophole through the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. The agreement, the Times says, is disastrously ill-timed because it undercuts some of the most powerful arguments Washington can make to try to galvanize international opposition to Iran's nuclear adventurism. So, what's going on? Well, according to an article in the March issue of Monthly Review, the U.S. plans to take advantage of India's nuclear ambitions for its own strategic purposes. This article is by the Research Unit for Political Economy, based in Mumbai, India. Their argument is that as the U.S.'s capacity to control the world militarily reaches the breaking point, it needs to persuade other nations to provide support for its far-flung operations. The authors draw on several sources of information close to the U.S. government, and I'll give you a website where you can find the references and the whole article in a few minutes. To begin with, we have to be clear that the U.S. has committed itself to a state of permanent war to maintain its status as the dominant imperialist world power worldwide. Directly and through its support of compliant governments, it maintains physical control of much of the world's crucial resources, such as oil, as well as of trade routes. To that end, the U.S. spends 3.5 times as much on the military as China, Russia, Britain, and France combined. The United States is the only country with the infrastructure and forces to project military force over long distances and thus to fight sustained wars abroad, as it is doing in Iraq and Afghanistan at present. But this huge military effort rests on a fragile economic base. Our economy is sustained by going increasingly into debt to other nations, making the United States by far the world's largest debtor. This sinking process cannot go on forever. Eventually, we will no longer be able to service this massive debt. Investors will go elsewhere. The dollar will fall, interest rates will rise, and the U.S. economy will be in danger of collapse. Military power plays a big role in delaying this disaster by maintaining U.S. influence over resources and trade routes. Nevertheless, the military is overextended. It has to be everywhere at once. It has a poor record against guerrilla resistance and popular upsurges, Vietnam and the present Iraqi insurgency being examples, and it has limited capacity to expand because of domestic resistance to casualties and the military draft, thanks to the war in Vietnam. So the problem this sets for U.S. strategists is how to do more with less, how to dominate the world when it can't be everywhere at once. This is where the deal with India comes in. A study from the U.S. War College states bluntly, we need tangible Indian support because our strategic interests and objectives are global, while the military and other means at our disposal to pursue them are not keeping pace. American force posture remains dangerously thin in the Indian Ocean and in the Pacific. Now, there are several things India is slated to do to support the U.S. military. First, it can provide lily pad bases, that is, forward operating sites, which would have minimal permanent facilities and limited permanent detachments, and they would serve mobile forces dispatched from the United States as required. Apart from main operating bases and lily pads, there will be even more skeletal sites called cooperative security locations. With little or no permanent U.S. presence, these may be maintained by contractor or host nation personnel. The United States wants a free hand to use these sites as it wishes. Secondly, the U.S. Navy wants a relatively neutral territory on the opposite side of the world that can provide ports and support for operations in the Middle East. India not only has a good infrastructure, the Indian Navy has proved that it can fix and fuel U.S. ships. Over time, port visits must become a natural event. India is a viable player in supporting all naval missions, including escorting and responding to regional crises. Third, the United States also wants facilities for training in India. According to one American official, India has a variety of landscapes, from ice-clad mountains to deserts, and it would help the Americans because military training ranges are shrinking and becoming increasingly controversial in the United States. And finally, according to the same source within the government, the U.S. military seeks a competent military partner that can take on more responsibility for low-end operations in Asia, such as peacekeeping operations, search and rescue, humanitarian assistance, disaster relief, and high-value cargo escort, which will allow the U.S. military to concentrate its resources on high-end fighting missions. What is inducing India to play along with this strategy? India is being offered the chance to be a lead player in an Asian version of NATO, a military alliance. Alliance against whom? China, of course. So it's crucial to nourish India's great power ambitions, and nuclear energy and nuclear weapons are a part of that. Only if India sees itself as a great power, a counterpoise to China in the region, will it want to promote a broad anti-China alliance. And so the United States must push India to pursue its, quote, manifest destiny. But crucial to making this system work is India's being convinced of its manifest destiny and for it to act forcefully. It will require, in the main, that New Delhi think geostrategically and give up its diffidence when it comes to advancing the country's vital national interests and to give up its almost knee-jerk bias to appease friends and foes alike. The corrective lies in the Indian government expressly defining its strategic interests and focus and, at a minimum, proceeding expeditiously toward obtaining a nuclear force with a proven and tested thermonuclear and ICBM, as intercontinental ballistic missile, reach. Nothing less will persuade the putative Asian allies that India can be an effective counterpoise to China in the region or compel respect for India in Washington. So India, in other words, has to become more belligerent than it has been historically. So there you have it. India is not merely being permitted, but being encouraged to develop nuclear capabilities as a way of drawing it into a kind of illusory junior partnership with the United States in its ongoing imperial project. The likely result is to suck India into a potentially fatal nuclear arms race with China as China seeks to maintain nuclear parity with a neighbor allied with the U.S. against it. I've had time today to just sketch the argument of this important article. To read the whole thing, get the monthly review for March, or you can see it online at monthlyreview.com. I'm Clayton Morgridge with the Well-Read Red. Next up on the Old Mole here on KBOO, we have our movie moles, Fran Michel and Jan Hocken, to tell us what they think of Crash, the movie about race relations in L.A. that won this year's Oscar for Best Picture.
Good morning. This is Fran Michelle here with Jan Hocken to discuss Crash, winner of this year's Academy Award for Best Picture and available on DVD at venues around Portland, including the Multnomah County Library. The film presents a series of overlapping stories during a couple of cold days in Los Angeles. It opens with a plainclothes detective played by Don Cheadle speculating that people crash their cars into each other because they find it so impossible otherwise to make contact. He himself has troubled contacts with his Latina partner and his drug-addicted mother, who prefers his ne'er-do-well younger brother. Meanwhile, two young black men complain about racial profiling and then carjack a white district attorney and his wife. She mistrusts the young Latino locksmith who replaces the locks on their house doors, but when she falls down the stairs, discovers that her Latina housekeeper is the only one who's there for her. Elsewhere in L.A., Matt Dillon plays a racist white cop who's pissed off at the HMO that won't help his dying father, and he takes it out in a traffic stop of a wealthy black couple in an SUV, sexually molesting the wife, played by Tandy Newton, and alienating his rookie white partner, played by Ryan Philippe. Later, the Dillon character rescues the Newton character from a burning car crash, and the indignant Philippe character, whose black supervisor has given him a hard time about changing partners, picks up a black hitchhiker and, in a panicky moment, shoots him. Meanwhile, an Iranian shopkeeper gets his daughter to help him buy a gun for protection after a robbery. He mistrusts the locksmith, who tells him he needs a whole new back door, and because he hasn't replaced the door, his insurance company won't cover the damages after another break-in. Furious, he takes the gun and goes looking for the locksmith, but discovers his daughter has filled the gun with blanks. Meanwhile, the carjackers run over a Korean who, it turns out, has been trafficking in Southeast Asian slaves. One of the carjackers later frees the slaves he discovers chained in the back of the Korean's van. And there are many other intersecting stories in this complicated film, which ends with a magical little computer-generated snowfall. We wanted to discuss this movie not only because it recently won Best Picture, but also because some friends of ours, whose opinions we generally respect, have had radically different responses to it. What are the people who like this film like about it? What's good about this movie?
Well, I once lived in L.A., and I felt, and some of the people who have liked it most actually are from L.A., and I think it does capture some of this vast web of interlocking freeways of pieces of life that can pass by very quickly. There are a series of vignettes. It doesn't stop anywhere for very long, so you have a kind of montage of human interest stories that are all bound together in the vast space of Los Angeles. You know, the last stop in the westward migration, the land of dream machines, Hollywood, unfulfilled longings, and people kind of bumping up against each other in this place of so much unfulfilled desire. And you see all these immigrants coming in, and there are intimations here and there of a broader social world and institutions that constrain people and bring out the worst in people. The shopkeeper who's undercapitalized, so he can't fix his door. The bad cop, the racist cop who is struggling to get health care for his dad. And so you have this side of people, the humane impulses here and there, the black producer who's helping this other kid out, who's on the street, and yet there's, I guess, the question of what all that amounts to, that here and there, these gestures in people that are otherwise blocked, like the freeways themselves, in the something about the whole effect of the society in mass that works against people.
Yeah, I mean, there is a kind of turn halfway through the film. I mean, the first half is sort of terrible things happen one after another, and then in the second half things, you know, there's a kind of shift in tone, and a few, some things turn out okay, and you know, the same characters who've the racist cop has, you know, he basically raped this woman and then he rescues her and saves her life, and
one of the least redeeming moments in the film.
It's
high melodrama.
It's high melodrama, and it's really one of the most offensive parts of the film, that this character is you know, is presented as he's so heroic. There's this kind of slow motion of him walking away from the crash and the smoke billowing behind him because he's done the right thing and he's saved this woman's life. And that's the image. The picture of Matt Dillon carrying Tandy Newton is the still that keeps getting reproduced in advertising for the film. And I think that really emphasizes the problem, the very problematic nature of this sort of repeated story of, you know, good white cop saves black woman, that is really, you know, one of the more offensive stories. But I think there are, you know, the stories do come out in different ways, and some of them are not that offensive. As you say, the TV producer, who's the husband of the woman who gets sexually molested and then rescued, but we see him. Dealing with stresses at work, having to sort of make sure that the black characters in the TV show are talking black enough to please the white producer he has to answer to, and so I mean we do get some pictures of this sort of hypocrisy or the manipulations of race. There are also the district attorney who is afraid after the carjacking he's either going to lose the black vote or the law and order vote if people find out about this, and so you know he wants to give an award or pin a medal on somebody black.
Tremendous the cynical operations and machinations of power and politics. But I thought one of the themes seemed to be the way in which particularly black people who were formerly outsiders are now have some place in the running of the city and the society, and you have these still immigrants coming in who are outsiders, but there's a struggle between, you know, blacks and whites, working class whites, over kind of the running of the everyday operations of society. You don't really see people with real power in the society. It's people bumping up against each other on the streets or in the office. And there was something partly compelling about the way in which characters shifted positions, where the racist white cop was in the subordinate position when he had to come to the woman who ran the HMO office to get help for his father. On the other hand, on the street, he could subjugate a black woman and humiliate her and her partners. So you had all of these shifting positions of power and people bound together in interdependencies that had to be confronted. And I think that was part of his saving her was, I think the film was saying, you know, we do depend on the LAPD, you know, the officers who serve the city can one moment molest you and the next moment save you. But we're caught in these very ambivalent, I guess somewhat sadomasochistic ties that bind city life together.
Yeah, and I mean, I think part of what's problematic about that from a sort of left perspective or from the perspective of some of the more progressive viewers of the film is that that really risks kind of flattening out the structures of power in the society and the larger structures of inequality and, you know, the things that create the situations in which some people have more access to resources and more access to power. And while it's true that, you know, that hierarchy and that structure is never simple, and people can, you know, in one situation be empowered and in another situation at another time be the one in the position of being disempowered. I mean, those aren't, you know, there isn't always a clear and hard line between those positions. But at the same time, you know, if we start saying, well, you know, everybody's oppressed and we all suffer from racism and it's bad for everybody, then we start to, I think, miss something that is really crucial about the fact that, in fact, you know, some people really do have more power. there really are structural inequalities and inequalities of wealth and inequalities of power that make a real difference in people's lives.
It also seemed to be a split between public life, which was generally alienating and kind of metaphorized, I guess, by the freeways and people crashing into each other and the way in which people recoup their humanity and personal life. There's so much about mothers, the son taking care of the mother taking care of the son, the Latino father who is a wonderful and taking care of his daughter. There's so much of the humanity of people was recouped through personal kinship ties, rather than finding humanity in some other, even glimmer of an alternative of view of public life.
Yeah, so not surprisingly for a mainstream film, there is once again this sort of retreat to an endorsement of private sphere relations as the solution. I mean, the film also, I think, to a large extent presents racism as something that is also a personal and individual problem, that it's psychologized so much that we don't really get a lot of sense of it as a structural issue. And so, for instance, when the racist cop goes to the HMO and he tells this story about how his father, who really needs help now, he started his own business and he worked side by side with all his employees who were all black, and then he lost a city contract because there was a preference, they put in a preference for hiring minority-owned businesses, but his father was never resentful, and then this reading of what's happened really sort of gets to stand as though, in fact, minority businesses really do, have a big leg up in the world and really are doing so well.
And it's an extraordinarily virtuous thing that a white would not be bitter about. That is the implication, that was kind of a statement about how extraordinary his character was.
Yeah.
Which grants a lot to that conservative racist kind of reaction, even indirectly.
Yeah. And then the response of the woman who works at the HMO is to say, well, your father sounds like a nice man, and if he had come in and asked for help, I might have been able to do something for him, but not for you. Which again, sort of personalizes the interaction, which, most of us could probably guess that, if an HMO tells you, no, we're not going to cover something, it's really not because the person at the other end doesn't want to. It's because they've got somebody breathing down their neck, and there's an enormous bureaucracy that is set up in the interests of the stockholders.
It was interesting that there were five pretty political films that were nominated for Academy Awards this year, and that there's, I think, clearly a market for people wanting to see films that deal with political questions, but this seemed to be sociology light.
Yeah, I mean, certainly the film is dealing with major questions about conflicts and racial conflicts in the U.S., particularly in Los Angeles. But it is doing it in a very personalized way, in a way that maybe is inviting white people to feel like, it's really, we're suffering too, and therefore it's not really our fault.
But it's encouraging that there is clearly so much interest in this country now in political films, to the extent that the Academy Award nominees register something in that area.
Yeah, I mean, Crash deals with racism. Brokeback Mountain was dealing with gay issues. Good Night and Good Luck was dealing with sort of the media monopoly and political pressure on media. Capote was dealing with the death penalty and the sort of morality of media representations and writing, and Munich, of course, is dealing with terrorism and anti-terrorism questions. So clearly there is an interest in a thirst for a recognition of some major issues and of the possibility, at least, that works of art and culture can really address these questions.
So Crash is not the last word. Jan Hocken and Fran Michel talking today about the recent Academy Awards and the film Crash.
This is the Old Mole Variety Hour here on KBOO, your community radio station. I'm Clayton Mordridge. And as I announced at the top of the show, there will be a major anti-war demonstration here in Portland on Sunday. Activist Michael McCormick, and a founder of Recruiter Watch, is in the studio to talk now with Bill Resnick. Bill.
Hi, thanks, Clayton. And Mike McCormick, welcome to KBOO.
Good morning. Thanks, Bill.
Mike McCormick has been real active in organizing the anti-war march and rally and talks this Sunday, and works with Recruiter Watch.
Recruiter Watch PDX.
Recruiter Watch PDX. There are Recruiter Watches all over the country.
There are several, actually,
yeah.
Yes.
The wars in the Middle East go on, so does the peace movement in Portland. Tell us about Sunday and who's sponsoring it and sort of the range of voices.
Well, this is actually an action that is part of a whole network of actions across the country. On the second anniversary of the war last year, there were actions in 765 different cities. There's probably going to be more than that this year on the third anniversary, this Sunday. Locally, there are, as of Thursday, there were 146 organizations either co-sponsoring or endorsing this rally and march, which include lots of folks and organizations from the faith community, lots of activist organizations from the Portland Labor for Peace and Justice, People of Faith for Peace, Portland Buddhist Peace Fellowship, Rainbow Coalition of Portland, the Arab American Palestine folks working for justice there, our group, Recruiter Watch PDX.
Anti-globalization or social justice globalization people, mm-hmm. A lot of the justice units.
Yeah. Alliance for Democracy, Peace and Justice Works, Portland Peaceful Response Coalition, American Friends Service Committee. It goes on and on.
You know the Code Pink,
they're very involved.
Involved. And very engaging sorts of methods activities during the march. The peace movement in planning for this march, of course, there were some controversies, and people had to settle on the larger sorts of kinds of demands or slogans or purposes of the march, and how broad the message ought to be. For example, I mean, always one crucial question now is should in fact the occupation of the West Bank and Gaza and sort of Israeli expansionism and then Palestinian responses, often which are terrible or not productive but understandable,
mm-hmm.
It seems to me that it's always a question, does one want to take on that when we're talking also about Iraq? And the decision was made to, in fact, have a quite broad set of understandings at the core of the march. And tell us a sense about how that dispute, you know, arose and what position you take on it, actually.
Well, I wouldn't call it a dispute, but
a discussion.
The impetus for taking on all those issues was to create the biggest network of organizations who would be organizing and supporting this event as possible, and therefore building the movement as broadly and deeply as possible.
Mm-hmm.
So we did have a lot of discussions about first, how would we state the theme of the march, which is End the War, Begin the Peace, and then what kinds of sub-themes would we include and publicize. And on that particular issue, we ended up with the sub-theme and the occupations of Iraq, Afghanistan, the West Bank, and Gaza.
Mm-hmm. Of course, the people who are opposed of having a real broad message say that you get more participation if you just stick to one thing, because you don't want to alienate some people who might be against the war in Iraq, but in fact are not critical at all of sort of the Israeli presence in the West Bank and indeed support it. So you don't want to offend people. And in fact, they say that about all sorts of things, like you don't want to let's say Gold Star Mothers and some of those groups that support veterans, people say we don't want to offend them because, in fact, they're not really against the war. They're just for the troops, and yet they want to march for the troops. So there are two ways of thinking of broadness, and obviously our coalition in Portland decided on the broadness of representing lots of people's troubles and problems and lots of ways of understanding the dilemmas.
Right. And we had long, productive, sometimes contentious discussions about that. And I think what came down finally was people understood the importance of having the broadest possible network and sponsorship.
Mm-hmm. It seems to me that one reason to, in fact, talk about the occupations, even to talk about the imminent attack on or whatever is going to happen in Iran, it's not quite clear how they're going to deal with it now. It seems to me we have to... It's not only thinking about the present. It might well be that if you dumb down your message to, you know, we're just killing children in Iraq, we have to stop that and sort of put up, you know, pictures of dead children, you might get a few people who somehow become anti-war because of that. But the problem with sort of that lowest common denominator organizing is that nobody really gets educated. They don't really get committed. They started being against killing children, and they remain against killing children, but they don't see more. They don't develop sort of commitments to, let's say, support the secular forces in the Middle East, to understand the Middle East, to understand the struggles there, to understand the possibilities, to identify it. If you just stick with lowest common denominator themes, it seems to me that what you do is sort of, even if that would create a little bit larger march, and I don't think it would, actually, but even assuming it would, what you've done is completely mortgage the future for the present to try and get a few more people, which I'm not sure it even would, again. But you dumb yourself down where you're not building movements, where you're not sort of helping people understand the world.
Mm-hmm. Well, the strategy in planning this event was put out a broad enough message in terms of the theme and the sub-themes to attract that broad spectrum of people and provide what we're doing. There are 40 different organizations who are going to have tables there, right, educating people about all these other sub-themes, issues, et cetera. So there is an opportunity for people to learn more, to get a deeper understanding of what the issues are.
Mm-hmm. Well, tell us, Michael, about the... in fact, have we on this program talked about the march and where we're gathering and things like that?
We are gathering this Sunday, the 19th, at Waterfront Park at 1:30 p.m.
At 1:30. Where in Waterfront Park, though? It stretches a while.
At where Oak Street meets Front Street.
Oh, that is it, where Oak meets Front. That's close to the Burnside Bridge, then. Is that
closer
right?
To the Morrison Bridge.
Oh, it's closer to the Morrison
Bridge. You know where the memorial...
Yeah. It's at between the Burnside and the Morrison Bridge, where the memorial used to be. They're sort of ripped up that whole area now.
In fact, we have some logistical challenges there with fences and things. Oak Street is the only entry into Waterfront Park. North, you can get in north of there, but you can't get in south of Oak.
Well, it's going to be a good march anyway.
We expect 10,000 or more people.
Yeah, it's going to be...
Right, and it'll start with a rally with speeches and music and then turn into a march. It'll go downtown.
Mm-hmm. And lots of materials to read and good talks, I hope, and good chants. Who's worked on the chants?
I don't know specifically who's
worked on it. Really, good chants are so important.
Yeah.
If I had another life, I would spend my time... figuring out good chants for marches. Of course, the drum corps is there. It's always quite wonderful.
Yeah.
Michael, let's talk about Recruiter Watch that you're active in. Tell us about it.
It started last August when we learned that there was a lot of recruiting activity in targeted schools in Portland. Those schools that have the highest percentage of low-income students of color.
They're not going to Lincoln. They're going to Marshall and Jefferson. Marshall and Roosevelt.
Right. Very much targeting low-income students of color because they know they have fewer options than the rest of us. So we have...
Well, the middle-class parents don't want their kids joining the Army, period.
Well, that's true. That's true. So we've been leafleting students and their parents and setting up meetings with teachers and doing workshops for their students in their classes in various high schools, meeting with PTSAs and site councils of schools to work with them to educate students and to educate the administration about one of the things that's important is that students understand that they can opt out of having their names sent to the Pentagon to be given to recruiters. Under the No Child Left Behind legislation, the federal government requires schools to send lists of their students and contact information to them in order to get federal funding for the schools, unless the students say and give official notice, written notice to their school administration, they don't want that to happen. So we've been giving them the forms and the information in order for them to do that.
How about, do you have a political message for people? I know you can tell them. They promise you education, they promise you money, they promise you to see the world, and of course all those promises are utterly hollow, and some of you are going to be just killed, and most of you are just going to be kept in barracks somewhere is what happens, one way or another. And the education money, most kids don't qualify for. And
yeah, even though they pay into it. The military has a program for recruiters to contribute part of their pay on a monthly basis for their own educational fund. And there are instances where they don't even get that back when they get out.
Hideous scams, actually. Scams by insurance companies that sell insurance policies to kids in the Army at extremely high rates.
And now the Army National Guard is offering bounties to people to get people to sign up for the military. $2,000 for anybody who convinces a person to sign up and report for basic training.
$2,000?
Yes. And they're offering $20,000 bonuses.
Michael, let's go down there. You need, you know, you'd look good in khaki. with your glasses.
I'm not promoting the practice. I'm saying this is a bounty. They're putting money on the heads of potential recruits.
You know, they're also putting money on people, on Pakistanis and Afghanis who are brought by militias to the American to go to Guantanamo or Bagram or other places. You know, most of the people there were not captured on the battlefield.
Right.
They were brought in as Taliban or Al-Qaeda or whatever by others.
Yes.
For like between $5,000 and $20,000.
Yes.
And it's a huge amount of money. So
Now we have our own domestic
bounty
program.
A lot of people are swept up. Most of these prisoners are just people who have been turned in for... You know,
Evidence whatsoever.
No evidence
have anything
whatsoever.
To do with terrorism.
It's a growth industry.
Right.
Oh, and we have that here too, of course. And you know, I imagine that parents walk in there with their kids. Can a parent get the $2,000?
Yes. Yes.
Holy
parents,
cow.
Neighbors, your uncle.
Quite remarkable. We have to. What a degradation of American life that the military is now creating in so many, 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 many ways. The militarization of the U.S. Michael, thanks for coming to talk to us, and keep up the good work. But tell us again, let's get the details of the march out there again.
Rally and march are this Sunday, March 19th at 1:30 p.m. at Waterfront Park.
Okay, 1:30 p.m. this Sunday, which is the 19th.
Yep.
At Waterfront Park. Thanks a lot for talking to us.
Thanks, Bill.
And that's it for the Old Mole Variety Hour this week. Let me remind you again that march is at the entrance to Waterfront Park at Oak Street near the Morrison Bridge. Well, Bill Resnick earlier in the show talked with Douglas Raybeck from Hamilton College. The Movie Moles reviewed Crash. And the Well-Read Red summed up the article, Why the United States Promotes India's Great Power Ambitions, by the Research Unit for Political Economy, which you can find in the Monthly Review for March and at their website, monthlyreview.com. I'm Clayton Morgridge. Our engineer is Tammy Dean. The Mole will be back next Monday morning at 9 o'clock with more news, views, reviews, and interviews about topics and from points of view you don't get anywhere else. Stay tuned now for Health Watch.
Good morning. It's 10 o'clock, and we're going to continue on with the Radio Zine this morning for March 13th, Monday. Coming right up, it's Health Watch with Dr. David Naiman, hosting a roundtable discussion today with a naturopathic physician and a Chinese herbalist and acupuncturist about chronic pain and headaches. At 10:30, it's The Dirt Bag with host Glenn Andreessen, discussing tasks in the produce garden, including cover crops, compost, and starting veggies. And at 11 o'clock on Democracy Now!, a remembrance of American peace activist Tom Fox, whose body was found in Baghdad over 3 months after he was kidnapped, along with three other members of the Christian peacemaker teams. And a look at the crimes of Slobodan Milosevic, who died this past weekend.